Okay, church history. So last time we finished up on Thyatira. So we'll be going into Sardis. We closed talking about the Paulicans, which are a group very much like ourselves, and they had a long history. And so we ran you through some stuff there. You're going to come upon some more names here in the future pretty quickly as we go into Sardis. But Sardis opens up the true, the Middle Ages are considered from 500 to 1500 AD, with the Reformation starting roughly around 1500. You're now going into the darkest period of the Dark Ages. A lot of that is because of the papacy, which we'll talk about here in a little while. But Sardis means red ones. That's the meaning of the word. And that gives you the idea of the martyrdom. Let me take you back real quick to Revelation 3. Revelation 3. There's just two or three things to be noted and that do follow through in church history for these folks spiritually. Revelation chapter 3. And notice, okay, Sardis, and we know that means red ones. This fits with what's going on around 1000 to 1500 AD, right up to the Reformation. But he says, these things in verse 1 saith, he that hath the seven spirits of God and the seven stars, I know thy works, that thou hast a name, that thou livest but art dead. Now, there's probably some ways that fits real well with what goes in this time frame with the Catholic Church. She has a name that she's alive, but she's not. She's dead. And this, of course, will also, there's going to be a lot of Christians that fall into the casualty category in this time frame too. But the church made a name for herself that she's alive, but she's not. She's dead. And there's nothing that fits better than that with the Catholic Church in that day and age. Now, I know that you may get tired. You may think, because we live in America, that talking bad about the Pope and talking bad about the Catholic Church is kind of a gimme. And so it's easy to do. But you don't understand if you don't understand. You don't understand history. Because there have never been a more vile, debauched, bandit squad of men that have ever lived than the Roman Catholic popes. And so we're going to talk about that in a little while. And just so you know, the Catholic Church in America in 2026, her ways are movable, okay? But she's not doing what she did back then, but she's also not repented of anything she did back then either, which indicates that there's coming a day when the Antichrist rises, that she'll be right back in the bloodletting, just so you know. But in, talks about she's made a name for herself that she's alive, but she's dead. Says, be watchful and strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die. So whatever's alive in it is, it's still just about ready to die. And you'll see as time progresses that there were some guys that came out of the Catholic Church. Savonarola and Arnold of Brescia. Wycliffe was a Catholic. In fact, I hate to tell you this, but Wycliffe, as heroic as he was, never became a non-Catholic. He taught against the Catholic Church what she taught, but he died after having given Mass, and I don't think he believed the Eucharist as they believed it, but he died after giving Mass on, he died of a stroke. So I'm just saying that there are folks that come out of it. Now, this church is dead. You see there, you see that. There is, again, no more debauched group of people in the world than what was going on at that time in the Catholic Church. Now, it does mention verse 3, remember, therefore now how thou hast received and heard and hold fast and repent. If therefore thou shalt not watch, I will come on thee as a thief, and thou shalt not know what hour I shall come upon thee. Thou hast a few names, even in Sardis, that have not defiled their garments. Okay? So we're going to see some names, not tonight, but later. Like I said, a guy named Arnold of Brescia, a guy named Henry of Lausanne, those guys were all street preachers. They rose up and preached what was right and good. They preached on the street. And there are, Savonarola was another one. And so we're going to see them. And they were not true Albigenses or Waldensians, but they did their own part in really setting up for the Protestant Reformation. So there's a few names. We'll reach out to those later. But at this point, we've kind of come through church history, and I've told you what was developing, you know, bad, and then we've gone on to the good guys. Well, at this point, there's not much to say. The best thing to do is just follow the papacy through, because the papacy really gives you a real clue what's going on. I don't intend to bore you to death with stuff, and this is all hitting extremely high points, because the popes all interfered in every country that they could get their fingers into. They set up kings, deposed kings, had wars, started wars, and all sorts of things. And so to go through all that is way too much. I mean, that's something for a more of an encyclopedic book. But we went through a couple of several pages here a few weeks back of papal debauchery. And there are just several names that come out of it. And you'll see a few more here in a little bit. But I'm just going to go through and track high points of the papal system. And it's going to cover, by the time we get through in another week, probably next week or so, I guess I won't be here, but it's going to cover, we're going to go through about 300 or 400 years kind of really quickly. And I'm not going to give you a whole bunch of details other than just to show you, don't get lulled asleep by this nice Chicagoan who is now on the papal chair. He's as much a killer as anybody else. He's a power hungry. He's lost. And he is a false prophet. He is a setup for the Antichrist. I'm just telling you. Look, anybody that can believe that somebody can stand up, say magic words, and turn bread into the flesh of Christ, there's something wrong with them. Amen. And to try to sell that to everybody and then say, you're gonna all go to purgatory and suffer for a few hundred years. There's something wrong with them. Namely, they're liars. Namely, they're inspired by Satan. So you just need to know. Now, I was counting, and there's like 250-something popes now in history. When you see the list, I mean, I have the list right here, ending with Leo the 14th, right? You know, there's a whole list, and you look at this innocent list, and these guys are supposed to be the vicars of Christ and represent Jesus Christ on earth and all this kind of stuff. And what you don't see in here is how they killed each other, how they committed the most raunchy adultery and sodomy you could ever imagine. They were poisoned. They poisoned each other. They bought church offices. I mean, they bought the papacy. Over and over again, these guys are buying the papacy. And so we're going to run through some of that. And, you know, there's one guy that managed to stay on the throne for 23 days before he was poisoned. And there you find on this list, there are times there are 4 and 5 popes at one time. There's the pope, and then there are these anti-popes that were elected by, you know, rebellious people who didn't follow the pope. And so sometimes there are these popes having fights with one another and appointing different kings in different countries. There's sometimes multiple popes, and sometimes there are no popes. By the way, there was one lady pope who had a baby on the street. So anyway, I'm just telling you that this is that I'm going to run through this. So you saw up there the papacy, and you see, of course, we've been through this, the rise of it, 300 to 600, the growth of it, 600 to 1,000. So that's what we saw in Thyatira. Now we're coming into the power of it. So this is the most debauched time. This is the midnight hours of the papacy, where it's the most powerful. And again, this will show that the papacy is nothing but a hypocritical, murderous, adulterous, power-hungry head of the old whore. There's just nothing good about it. And what looks innocent is all the Catholic charities and everybody doing all these things, and who is that lady in India and all that kind of stuff. It's all supposed to be just so wonderful, and it's not wonderful. Okay. So Gregory the Fifth, and you don't, of course, you don't care about these names and stuff, but just Gregory the Fifth was the last pope of the first millennium. So he died in 999 and probably was poisoned, from what they believe. But Sylvester II took over for him. He was the first French pope, for what it's worth. It was said that he sold his soul to the devil for the papal crown. And what that means is that he was willing to do anything that anybody wanted him to do in order to get it, including buying it. He took the name Sylvester because Otto III, the emperor, wanted a kingdom like Constantine had in the days of Sylvester I. So when they got this set up, Otto died, and again, he was poisoned, and it just didn't work out. So this pope dies, and he has to go to somewhere else. But there were various other short-term popes that followed those days, where, you know, several times, just one after another in a sequence of months. And a lot of times they're killed, a lot of times they're poisoned, a lot of times they do die of natural deaths. So it's just a soap opera of how it all happened. But one pope after another bought the papacy. Benedict the Eighth, we're now up to 1012 through 1024, bought the papacy with raw bribery. Another Gregory was anti-pope during his tenure. Now, an anti-pope, again, is a pope that's elected non-canonically by a rival faction of leaders. So whoever was electing the pope, there would be other factions that elected another guy, and so these two guys would have to fight it out to see who was the real pope, and a lot of times they started wars in other countries and everything else. It's amazing. But like I said, Benedict VIII bought the papacy with raw bribery. John the 19th, 1024 to 1032, was Benedict's brother. So there's familial ties in all this stuff, where a lot of times, you know, a father puts in his son, or a father puts in his brother, or a father puts in, you know, whoever else, whoever he wants to. But John the 19th was Benedict's brother. He bought the office too. And by the way, he passed through all the clerical degrees in one day. See, there are actually supposed to be qualifications for the pope. And if you rise up too fast, then they have to still, you know, put this on whatever you call it, your qualifications. And so he passed through all the clerical liturgies in one day and became suddenly qualified after 24 hours. So he passed through it all. So you can see this is all money. It's all money and all, it's all power. Benedict the Ninth, up in the mid thousands, that is 1033 to 1045, was a nephew to John. He ascended to the papacy when he was 10 years old. He became pope at 10. His election was a money bargain between his family, the clergy, and the Romans. During his reign, there were three rival popes. So there were two anti-popes, him, Gregory the Seventh, and Sylvester the Third. And I've always just found funny this whole second, third, fourth, ninth, 12th, 14th, and 19th stuff. It's just ridiculous. I think I wanted to read you something here. I won't be doing a lot of it tonight. Yep. Three rival popes, Benedict the Ninth, Gregory the Sixth, and Sylvester the Third. The feuds of these people, basically there was much killing, and again, there was intrigue, poisonings, and everything else. I want to tell you just a little bit about Benedict the Benedict. Which Benedict is this? What did I say? Where'd he go? I lost him. Oh, Benedict the Ninth or Eighth. Anyway, the boy pope. He combined the childishness of Caligula and the viciousness of Heliogabalus Those are Roman rulers. He grew worse as he advanced in years. He ruled like a captain of banditti, so bandits, committed murders and adulteries in open daylight, robbed pilgrims of the graves of martyrs, and turned Rome into a den of thieves. These crimes went unpunished, for who could judge a pope? I mean, he's the vicar of God. You can't judge a pope. You'd be like judging God. His brother Gregory was the patrician of the city. At one time, it's reported he had the crazy notion of marrying his cousin and enthroning a woman on the chair of St. Peter, but the father of the intended bride refused unless he abdicated the papacy. One guy who himself afterwards became pope said this of the boy pope. He says, this guy, he couldn't bring himself to fully describe his detestable life of this Benedict, who he says followed the footsteps of Simon Magus rather than Simon Peter, and proceeded to, in a career of rapine, murder, and every species of felony, until even the people of Rome became weary of his iniquities and expelled him from the city. So that can't be good, in case you're wondering. Because there were three popes at that time, Henry III, who's the emperor, brings in Clement II and deposes the other three popes totally, kicks them out and puts his own pope in. Henry crowns Clement, who then turns around and crowns Henry and calls him the emperor crowned by God. Nice little hand-in-hand action there. Okay, I'll make you pope. Okay, I'll crown you king crowned by God. How about that? Oh, that's good, buddy. High five. Yay! Somehow, though, Benedict the Ninth, the boy pope, still managed to hop back on the throne as Benedict the Tenth a little bit later on, but he died after a year of reigning. So on my list here, I can show you, I have, you know, Benedict the Ninth and Benedict the Tenth. And nobody ever says that it's the same person. The first one that got booted, and then he found his way back in somehow and died after a year. So it's just wretched. Domitius II got on the throne for 23 whole days before dying either of fever or poison, and they suspect poison. Leo the Ninth, this is, we're up in the 1050s now, came to Rome in the garb of a pilgrim, bawling and crying, pretending to be spiritual. He found the papal treasury empty. All the money's gone. And so then he's mad. Wonder why. Interestingly, Leo brought with him a guy that we will spend just a tad of time with because he's around. He's a guy named Hildebrand. If you ask a Roman Catholic historian, this guy was a great, great man. We'll see. Hildebrand came in and became the financial and policy advisor who essentially ran the papacy through the next five popes. He was brilliant as far as brilliance goes and was apparently really good at manipulating people. So he ran the papacy. An example of his influence, when Stephen X died in 1058, the Romans elected Benedict X, that was the boy pope that came back, to be pope in Hildebrand's absence. So Hildebrand secured help from a couple of the powerful dukes and expelled Benedict and appointed Nicholas II. So this guy's powerful enough to say, that doesn't work, we're going to make another pope. He basically controlled who was pope for the next five or six administrations. Well, Nicholas II, Nicholas called a council and transferred the election of the pope to cardinals and bishops. So we talked today about the College of Cardinals. He did that. And this was taken out of the... So he takes that out of the emperor's hand. To this point, the emperor had the right to elect the pope. Now we're going to do it all with cardinals. And so this became a major issue, and they fought back and forth about it a lot. We'll see more about that later. But he also prescribed that the Pope should come from the Roman clergy, nowhere else. Alexander II came to power in his days. Honorius the second was elected anti-pope. And again, so this is just a guy that's elected by a rival faction. And so these guys have to fight with each other and all that kind of stuff. He actually thought that the priest should be able to marry and have concubines, but Alexander wouldn't have anything to do with it. Anyway, Hildebrand was elected pope in 1073. He changed his name to Gregory the Seventh. Not that you would have to remember these names or anything, but just Hildebrand became Gregory the Seventh. He believed in papal absolutism. He said he wanted to morally reform the clergy class. It didn't work out very well, but he laid all the groundwork for papal infallibility. He deposed, and I'll tell you the story, parts of the story in just a second, but he deposed Henry IV, the Emperor of Germany, twice. Now here's a pope in Rome who is deposing, kicking a king in Germany off the throne. If you can make it work, you can make it work. If you have enough power to do it, you can, and he did. But he wound up kicking the Emperor of Germany twice off the throne. He told Spain that she belonged to the Apostolic See, S-E-E. That means that he said, you belong to me, you'll do what I say. And they said, yes, sir. He told Philip I of France that if he didn't pay the taxes that the Pope wanted to wage against him, that he would put him under interdict and destroy his kingdom. Again, the Pope has the power to say, to release all the Catholic subjects under a Catholic king and say, you don't have to obey him anymore. And if you do obey him, we're not going to give you the Eucharist, so you can't be saved. We're not going to baptize your babies, and you can't be buried in a Catholic funeral, Catholic cemetery. So effectively, he causes all the good Catholics in the country to be lost. Well, they're not going to put up with that. And so in the end, the king suffers and gets put out. And so he threatens that, and by the way, he does that again. But we'll talk more about that as I get down to this. Now, this guy is a monk, became the pope when Alexander II died. Again, there's a lot of things that he did that the Catholic Church thinks is great. Now, what you have to understand here is that the Catholic Church think these guys are great because they believe that they helped the Roman Catholic Church to survive when everything was going south with the barbarians and all that kind of stuff. And no matter what these guys did, they still were preserving the Catholic Church. So that's why they're heroes. He enforced celibacy. He forced even married priests to comply. Most people don't realize that a priest still usually could be married up until about 1000 AD. So this was something that, again, her ways are movable. Okay, she just shifts with the winds, and that's what she still does. He believed in total papal supremacy to this point, and what that would mean is going to be laid out here. He believed and set up that the Roman Church was founded by God alone. The Roman Pope alone is the universal bishop. The Pope alone may use the imperial insignia. Nobody else can use his stamp. When he stamps it, it's stamped. The Pope's feet alone may be kissed by princes. A prince is never to kiss anybody else's feet. Thanks, Papa. the Pope may depose emperors. So a guy in sitting in Rome who's not an emperor can mess up something in the British kingdom by kicking their king off the throne if he doesn't approve of what he's doing. So what you need to ask is, how does a guy in Rome control British politics or German politics? Well, the way he controls them, first of all, he has a bunch of followers who are Catholics that he can use to pressure the king. Furthermore, other kings who will go along with the Pope, they all have armies. And he can promise them all kinds of good stuff to come their way if they'll use their armies for the Pope. So that's the way it works. It's all politics, power, and money. But the Pope may depose emperors. The Pope may be judged by no one. Nobody gets to judge Papa. The Roman Church has never erred, E-R-R-E-D. The Roman Church has never erred, nor will it ever. Not even in the Nazi concentration camps. As Pope Gregory VII, Hildebrand referred to himself as the overlord of kings and princes. The overlord. He's the king of kings and lord of lords. Ain't that something? Anyway, so investiture is something that became a major deal. I've kind of talked about it before, but investiture. What that means is that up to this point, the emperors of their separate countries, France, Germany, Spain, whatever, they had the right within their own countries to have a say in who the bishops were, the archbishops, and so on within their country. In other words, okay, the Pope is the Pope, and we're a Catholic country, but the archbishop and the bishops and so on are going to be, if I'm the king of Spain, are going to be Spanish, right? Well, the Pope quickly undermined that. And so investiture, they argued back and forth about it, where the kings no longer had any right or any say, first of all, in who might be Pope, who should be voted on, who is elected or nominated. And secondly, they had no right to choose who would be the Archbishop of Canterbury. Say, it's the Pope who gets to do that. And so if the king disagrees and kicks out the Archbishop of Canterbury that the Pope placed there, the Pope's going to put an interdict against his country, and they're going to go at it. And that's exactly what happened. So, with the investiture issue that came out of it, are you bored? Is this too much? Because I'm going through a lot fast. So, let me recover what I was going to say here. Henry the IV, the King of Germany, he didn't like that Gregory was doing this on the investiture issue. He says, I ought to have the right to appoint my own Catholic archbishops and stuff. I'm the king of the country. You're just the Pope in Italy. Well, so when Henry wouldn't accept Pope Gregory's archbishops and stuff, Gregory excommunicated Henry and absolved all of Henry's subjects, all the German people, from their allegiance to him. So they said, you don't have to follow Henry anymore. He's out of my favor. And so you don't have to obey any of his orders. You don't have to obey his men or anything else. So Henry becomes powerless under the ban because, again, the people are scared for their kids' salvation and, you know, and so on and so forth, because the sacraments can only be given by the Catholic Church. And if we make the Pope mad enough, then if we're serving Henry, then he's going to send our kids to hell. So Henry becomes powerless under the ban. And so after a period of months, he is forced pretty much to pay obeisance to the Pope. So I just wanted to read you what happened here. So Henry decides, because he's basically been depowered over his people by the Pope, that he should repent and see if he can make this thing right. And so he is going to go try to get in the Pope's graces. If I can just find the place. Okay. It's the winter of 1076 and 1077. It's one of the longest, coldest winters along that area of the Rhine that anybody's ever known. And so here's the king humiliated. He's got to go seek the Pope's favor. And so a few days before Christmas, Henry IV leaves Spires on a journey across the Alps as a penitent seeking absolution from the Pope. Now he's traveling with his wife, his infant son, and all his entourage. And here's a king, and he's barefoot. He's walking barefoot because he's got to show the proper humility before the vicar of Christ. I mean, he's traveling across entire countries, miles and miles, across mountains, barefoot, to get to this guy. Henry arrives at the foot of the castle steep, where this is called Kenosha, by the way, where the Pope was staying in 1077. The cold was severe on the ground, covered with snow. For 3 days, from the 25th to the 28th of January, he stood in the Pope's court between the inner walls as a penitent suppliant, with bare feet and bare head, in a coarse woolen shirt, shivering in the cold. Now, this is a king standing in the cold. The Pope is keeping him out there in the courtyard, refuses to open the door for 3 days. He's out there barefoot, without a coat, without a hat on his head, because he's got to be properly humiliated. And so the Pope finally comes out and lets him and forgives him and sends him back to his country. But when he got back to his country, Henry's enemies in Germany had by that time elected a new king. His name was Rudolf. And Henry's friends were mad, of course, and they were going to fight with Henry. But the election, by the way, was done in front of the Pope's legates, his representatives, and they didn't say boo. So the Pope, although he had forgiven Henry, lets the people elect a new king, Rudolf. So when Henry gets an army up and goes and fights against Rudolf, Rudolf wins. And the Pope says, I think you should be king now, Rudolf. In spite of, you see how the Pope is running this thing. The Pope is causing this problem. Henry demands that the Pope ban the robber of his crown, and when Gregory refuses, Henry goes to war but loses the war. So, let me see if I can read my notes here. When Henry tried to get back on the throne, the Pope banned Henry as king and forbade all of the Roman Catholics in his kingdom to listen to him. And so now Gregory dies, and so you got two popes. Two different popes now elected, and two different kings in Germany, and they just war against each other. So by the time it's all said and done, Hildebrand, the Gregory the Seventh, the Pope, falls into problems, political problems, and Henry regains his power. And so he crosses the Alps to depose the Pope. And so the Pope is excommunicated by the king and thrown in jail because he has more soldiers than the Pope now. Okay? And so what is the jailed Pope going to do now? Well, the jailed Pope, let me just read that to you a little bit. And folks, you got to trust me. There's 30 stories like this of this kind of interference, this kind of thing going on. It's almost comical. But here we go. So Henry is Gregory the Pope is effectively in jail, not a real jail, but he's kept under house key because he's a pope and he doesn't deserve jail. Truly, he just deserves to be sequestered. Well, Gregory the Pope calls to his aid the Norman chief Robert Guisard. Now, by Norman chief, we're talking about a barbarian. He calls him in and hires him, and the bold adventurer, this is Robert, comes and rescues the Pope, liberates the Pope, and puts him in the Lateran Palace. So he puts him back in the Vatican Palace. But the cost of the Pope hiring this Norman barbarian chief to come in, after he installs him in the Lateran Palace and pays him, then this guy goes to the cities of Rome, and half the city was reduced to ruins. Churches were demolished. Others turned into forts. Women and maidens, even nuns, were outraged. And several thousand citizens sold into slavery by these barbarians. Now, this is the guy that came and rescued the Pope. And the Pope's good with it because he got back in power. Anyway, Gregory pretty soon dies after that, for what it's worth. But can you say how this is just a mess? Oh, by the way, when the Pope died, here was his testimony. I have loved righteousness and hated iniquity. Therefore, I die in exile. It's all total nonsense. But anyway, so after Gregory the VII, and through all this, there are many power disputes between popes and kings. This is just one. There are literally hundreds of others, because these guys, there are 250 popes, and they've all interfered somewhere at some time. We come to, and I'm going to have to quit soon, but we come to Innocent the II. What a name that is, Innocent. By the way, Innocent the III is one of the most famous, wretched, and powerful popes to ever live. But this is Innocent the II. We're in the early 1100s now. And Anacletus the II were elected pope by their powerful families, the Fiangipanis and the Pier Leonis. I wonder what ethnicity they are. We're talking about Italian families with a bunch of money that are just paying off to buy their sons into the papacy. So they both fought over the papal chair. Anacletus took possession of Rome with the help of Norman armies and banished Innocent the II. Then Innocent fled to France and got sniveling and squalling and got the king there to come to war for him. And he got back on the papacy, and then they switched it back and forth several times. Bottom line is, whoever has the most army, most money, and whoever has the biggest army gets to be pope and stay pope and do anything that he wants. Now, folks, I mean, I'm just giving you really highlights here. I can direct you to a couple books. It's not hard reading either, where it's just one horrific crime after another. It's just ridiculous. Now, these guys are supposed to be the vicars of Christ. They're supposed to be representatives of Jesus Christ before a lost world. I'm talking about, there have not been a worse guild of men to ever live. Eugene III in the mid-1100s had to flee Rome because of Arnold of Brescia's preaching. You haven't met Arnold of Brescia yet, but he was a street preacher who rebelled against the Catholic Church, started getting people saved, and he caused a major uproar. And so Eugene had to flee Rome because of this guy's preaching, made it unsafe for him there. The papacy warred against the House of Hohenstaufen in Germany for over 100 years at this point. I probably need to stop because I'm going to get into a little bit longer story. I am moving through this fast. You're not going to have to put up with, if this is boring, you won't have to put up with it, too much more of it. I'm just trying to, if I can just prove one thing, it's just that if you ever get mad at us Baptists, do not go back to the Catholic Church. You couldn't do a worse thing. But we got to quit. Any questions or comments?